We're trying to conduct a serious scientific investigation.
Science, logic, reason.
Do you have any hard data?
Now, that's what I call science. You're listening to That's What I Call Science, the weekly radio show and podcast that brings independent and, we hope, interesting STEM, science, technology, engineering and maths content to you from Tasmania. The show is supported by Edge Radio, Hobart's premium youth station. So head to edgeradio.org.au for more info on all the things that they do and getting a bit of a grasp on community radio in Tasmania. My name is Neve Chapman and I'm joined today by Dr. Jess Melbourne-Thomas, who I'm extremely excited to share some of her knowledge with the world and to learn from myself today. So this is part of a three-part series that we're doing for International Women's Day. So if you listened in last week, you would have heard from our co-hosts and how we're really excited to be talking about how the show is maybe giving more visibility to women in STEM and the work that we do. But Jess is actually this year's Tasmania's Australian of the Year. And she has a deep, deep history of advocacy for greater diversity in STEM, and particularly experience and support for women in STEM. So, Jess, you use interdisciplinary research approaches to understand how marine socio-ecological systems respond to climate change or human activities to inform decision-making for sustainable development. So there's a few things I'd like to unpack there to start with.
So just for a bit of background here, I started a new job with CSIRO just over 6 months ago, and which was a progression for me in a direction I was really excited to be heading in, and in lots of ways was my dream job. And I got a shiny new title, which is as a knowledge broker and transdisciplinary researcher.
What is a knowledge broker?
I think people, depending on what background they come from, they might have a slightly different view of the exact function of that kind of role. But for me, it's about connecting science to the people that need it, and whether that is, you know, policy and decision makers or industry or the general public. You know, a conventional model where as scientists we do some work and we write a paper, we put it in a journal and we hope somebody reads it there and uses it in, you know, some important way, isn't really effective to address some of these, you know, more urgent global scale and even local challenges. And so finding ways to better connect is important. But equally, there's more and more evidence to suggest that being able to incorporate different sources of knowledge into the research process is really valuable. So we talk about knowledge co-production, where you work together with stakeholders as an equal partner in the research process, so that the science that ends up being developed is actually applicable to the problem. So that, you know, that could be working again with more directly with people from industry. It could be finding ways to incorporate knowledge from traditional and indigenous knowledge holders, or it could just be engaging in better ways with members of the community who have problems that need addressing. So
does that kind of include like having a multidisciplinary research team where essentially, you know, you're kind of addressing a problem by looking at it with lots of different angles and different levels of expertise, which generally gives you a more full picture of understanding the problem?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a whole bunch of terms that get used. There's multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary. and they in some ways they kind of blur into one. But basically, as you progress through them, the different approaches to the research question are more integrated, and you are more fully engaging non-academic participants in the research process.
So do you find with being more of a knowledge broker or multidisciplinary researcher that you're still, are you more so at the end of the really hard task of translating research into something for a user, or are you still driving research from the design phase and implementing new research programs? Or is it a combination of the two?
A combination. Okay. And importantly, it's learning from doing, right? So this is, to some degree, a new thing that we're trying to do, particularly, you know, in areas like ecosystem modelling, which is my background, where we use complex tools that are hard for people to understand. You know, they're driven by complex mathematics and people are put off, and it can be difficult to find ways to engage people in what that process actually means and what the results are. You know, learning by doing and finding, you know, in a kind of a cycle so that each time you try to do this, you can do it a little bit better. That's a real part of what I'm hoping to do in the role.
Yeah, awesome. So that brings me to my first question, which was, what is a marine socio-ecological system?
Okay. So, you know, it really just goes to the heart of it. It's more and more difficult to look at the biological and physical parts of the systems that we need to answer questions about in isolation of the human bits, because they're tightly coupled. The bits that we choose to conserve or manage in the biophysical part are dictated by what people value and the ways that they, what they understand and how they want to interact. And
so biophysical, are we thinking of like the fish, the structures under the sea, the coral, that kind of stuff? And then the socio-ecological is really what value we place on those things, how we interact with them. And essentially, I absolutely agree with you, we can't really look at one thing in isolation because it fits within this really complex world where that's driven by a whole bunch of different factors. So to try and look at one, you really need to get to the why through.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we were very closely connected with, particularly in Tasmania, right? We, you know, closely connected with and dependent on marine resources. And it looks likely that in the future, those dependencies are going to increase, if anything. And so we need to be thinking about how the social dimension and the economic dimensions, as well as the kind of more conventional biology, physics, chemistry.
That's fascinating, and I think it's really important. So does this touch on the work that you contributed to as part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or how people would hear it probably most commonly in the media, just IPCC?
So the IPCC has regular assessment reports that it delivers every kind of 5 to 6 years, and then between that, the last big assessment report and the next one that's being developed at the moment, there was an agreement to deliver 3 special reports on key topics of interest. And one was the report on 1.5 degrees of warming above pre-industrial levels. One was about climate change and land, and the other was a special report on the oceans and cryosphere, so all of the frozen parts of the planet in a changing climate. And that third one was the one that I worked on, and wow. I was a contributor as an author on the polar regions chapter. So that was based on my experiences with change, climate-driven change in Antarctic ecosystems particularly.
So is leading something like that quite collaborative? That just sounds like a huge thing to essentially facilitate leading, because usually those things, if it's an international report, it includes a lot of bodies and negotiating different people's perspectives.
Yeah, it was a challenge, and not least because I accepted the role just before having my second baby. But yes, not only is that role about trying to synthesize really large volumes of science in the published literature into succinct assessments and messages that are accessible to particularly policymakers, but also engaging, you know, it's not like a one given author has all of the expertise that's needed. So you're absolutely right. It's collaborative. It's about seeking input from what, you know, we talk about contributing authors that will provide bits of text. And then the IPCC also has a very specific language it uses for reporting confidence and uncertainty around what we understand about the impacts of climate change and what we predict will happen in the future. So there's that element as well.
Wow, that sounds like a really exciting opportunity, but it also sounds like there's a key thread here, which is science communication, or essentially distilling what researchers are doing in their somewhat perceived as an ivory tower into something that's useful or user-friendly. Is that something that's contributed to your research interests or that you're particularly passionate about?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, learning about, you know, so the way that you might try to summarise science to deliver it to policymakers and governments looks very different from how you might think about translating science for the general public, or as I said before, for industry that's needing very applied information. So, and I find all that, you know, presenting to different kinds of audiences, I learn all the time about what questions are important to people, how they interpret language, right? You know, because the word, the scientific term that we use might mean something very different to someone who's not familiar with using that word in that situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. So Do you have any kind of take-home messages for people who are, you know, really want to get out there and share their science and make it meaningful and useful? You know, top tips. I think one of them really sounds like you've got to know your audience and tailor that, but also knowing how to pitch that and tailor that probably takes quite a lot of experience.
Yeah, I think both of those are absolutely true. You know, you're not going to get it right every time, and that's not the end of the world. You know, you learn from that, and listening is really key. Listening to what people are asking and saying, and what, you know, what's at the top of the list for them. We ran a really exciting program last year that you might have heard about called Curious Climate, which
was
a collaboration between the Centre for Marine Socioecology and ABC. And, you know, that was really about flipping science communication on its head, so that instead of the scientists making assumptions about what people wanted to hear about, we asked the public what questions they had about climate change. And I think finding ways to do that more will be increasingly important.
And there was really good uptake of that as well. And I listened to some of the outputs from that this week. And they're really, really fascinating. So I would recommend that people check that out.
Yeah.
We'll share it as part of this interview. So in just a moment, we're going to be touching on some experiences of women in STEM and maybe challenges of being a woman in STEM and having authority while communicating science. So you've been listening to That's What I Call Science. Stay tuned for more. You're listening to That's What I Call Science. I'm Neve Chapman, and today I'm interviewing Tasmania's Australian of the Year, Dr. Jess Melbourne Thomas. Today's show is part of our International Women's Day series or mini-series, and we've just been talking about some of Jess's work, but we just finished off talking there about communicating science and how you need to know your audience, but also maybe tell a compelling narrative that is going to change for each person. Mm. Have you found that have you associated any challenge or benefit of being a woman in that space? Because I've certainly seen a lot of data that would indicate that women aren't really put to the fore of science communication very often or don't hold much authority in that space. But what's your experience been?
Mostly pretty positive. You know, interesting, I had long dreadlocks for like 16 years, and often people would say, do you find that the way you look, you know, affects how your credibility is seen? But it never did, actually. You know, I always felt that, and maybe I was really fortunate to be operating in the spaces I was operating in, but it certainly, I was never aware of judgments that were being made. I think, you know, there is a need for more visibility of women in science in the media particularly, and there's a great program that I was lucky to be involved with called Superstars of STEM.
Superstars of STEM is run out of Canberra through Science and Technology Australia, and essentially I think they started with, what was it, 20 or 30?
30 of us, yeah.
Yeah, and now they're up to like 70, and they try and take women who are early, not there any range of where the stages of career, and they upskill to provide science communication staff, and you go out and deliver talks.
Yeah, it's very flexible based on, you know, what skills you want to develop, but yeah, opportunities to talk to the media, talk to schools, you know, recognizing that the women that participate in the program might come from quite different organizations and institutions, and so, you know, working around that. So it was a fantastic program to be involved with.
So I quite often see that some of the challenges that women experience are often quite related to children or caring responsibilities. In particular, you know, we talk a lot about the leaky pipe, particularly on our show, because I like to promote, yes, we need to encourage more women to pursue STEM, but that's probably more targeted for specific fields rather than as a whole. But actually, we've got a major issue of not supporting women from going from kind of early career through to leadership opportunities. And I wonder if your experience has changed over time.
I think there's increasing appreciation and flexibility around the way that anyone who acquires caring responsibilities has to balance that with work. And it's inevitable, nearly inevitable, that productivity changes over a, you know, whatever period of time you choose to invest in family. And certainly things like, you know, most of the big grant schemes are accounting for that now. But I also think that it can be a critical time when women particularly step back and look at the system that they've been part of, and and possibly see features of it that they, you know, aren't attractive anymore, and that can be a time when women choose to take a different pathway rather than pursuing whatever trajectory they would have been on towards leadership in academia or science. So, I think that absolutely does happen, and I think it's a real problem. I don't know what we do to fix it, but that those senior roles are perceived as so demanding. You know, you never meet a senior person in science or academia more generally who says, oh, yeah, no, it's great. You know, I have heaps of time to do the things I like.
Annual leave where you actually get to switch off from email is very rare.
Yeah. And I
find it really interesting what you're saying, because I quite often facetiously go, do women actually, though, just take a long enough break to realise, like, oh, this is what it feels like to be outside that space. And then actually they're making a fully informed decision. It's like, oh, I don't want to be part of that anymore. This is now my life goals, and I can get ways and means to support that through a different avenue. And I really think that the data seems to be missing on what is contributing to the leaky pipe. Like, is this actually people are just going, well, actually, I don't want to be part of that system anymore?
Yeah.
Or are we just assuming there's all these different biases that are factoring into it?
It's probably both, but I suspect you're right that we have less understanding of that kind of very conscious decision making, and more effort is around kind of concrete logistical things we might do to better support people to stay on whatever pathway they've been on, and things like, you know, job sharing and having more flexibility to do some of these roles part time. I think mentoring is really important, to be able to talk through those things and have role models who've made it work in different ways. And I certainly, I work with tons of fantastic scientists who they love what they do, and they're quite happy to work until, well, they're working on important things, and that's the kind of people they are, to invest all that they can in it. But it is an issue that then, you know, the view is that you can't be in a senior role like that without living that kind of lifestyle.
I kind of lately, so looking more and more, as we gear up to International Women's Day, there are a lot of women's events, and I've been toying with the fact that we're essentially making diversity in STEM diverse people's problem that they need to address and support. And on our show, we try to be particularly inclusive, and we work around family commitments. I prefer, as a student or full-time worker, to do it outside of work hours, but if I want to talk to somebody, I can make that work during lunchtime, and I'll just work a little bit later. But I wonder how much of that critical period where, you know, you've got a certain amount of time to build up your kind of independence and your track record, and women are continually being pulled from work hours to maybe go to women in STEM events, for example. But also a lot of networking opportunities or events or conferences take place away from home and out of work hours that makes it kind of difficult to attend. Are these maybe some systemic barriers as a whole sector we need to think about, or, you know, have you postured on any of these?
Oh, absolutely. I think they're all really valid points. And it's interesting because, having young kids, I haven't been able to travel to conferences and meetings and things. And, apart from that initial period of FOMO, it actually hasn't mattered that much.
That's good.
Some things would have been easier to do face to face, but, you know, mostly, you know, you might have to do a Skype meeting at 9 o'clock at night, but compared with having to go on a plane for 14 hours or more and be away from family, you know, some of those things, I hope we're moving towards a point where we feel that we can travel less, and that's so much better from an emissions perspective, and also just in terms of the pressures it places on people. So, I would hope that some of those expectations might be diminishing.
I think so. And I think as greater awareness is brought to the impact that they have, and potentially that they are pretty exclusive to those that can make it work, that hopefully we'll start challenging our sector to think about how we can disseminate knowledge even within academia better. Because I've been surprised how many people are like, oh yeah, we publish lots of papers, but actually it's at a conference where I tend to pick up most things and then I'll read the paper
I find it really interesting that I notice on Twitter that there are a lot of senior women that in science particularly that are really active and have really big followings, and there's probably been studies of this, but I suspect that Twitter particularly is a place, an alternative for you know, women to network and connect and disseminate if conferences aren't a possibility.
So you've been listening to That's What I Call Science. In just a moment, we're going to talk about some future directions for diversity in STEM, essentially, and also touch on the Homeward Bound project that Dr. Jess Melvin-Thomas co-founded. You're listening to That's What I Call Science. I'm Neve Chapman. Today I'm interviewing Tasmania's Australian of the Year, Dr. Jess Melbourne-Thomas. And it's part of our International Women's Day mini-series. And we've been talking a bit about Jess's work and also what it's like to be a woman in STEM and maybe how we can promote greater diversity. But I'd love to just start asking you about what is Homeward Bound? Because I know, and I've been interested in it for years. And like, where did it come from and how did it start?
So it kind of blossomed out of a connection between me and Fabian Dattner and also a group of other women working in Antarctic science, particularly in Tasmania. So Justine Shaw and Marianne Lee, who were also centrally involved as co-founders. And Fabian was running leadership courses for women in Tassie, and conversations emerged about some of the particular challenges for women scientists working in Antarctica, and you know, which has very much been a male-dominated space, and there are still a whole lot of challenges for women being away in those kinds of environments in polar science more generally, in the Arctic too. So the story goes that Fabian had a dream about taking a boat full of women to Antarctica, a ship full of women to Antarctica, and she called me the next morning, and she's a very difficult person to say no to. She said, "What do you think, Jess? Could we do this?" And it went from there, actually. And the original vision was to try to leave from Hobart, but for various reasons, it was actually more sensible to leave from South America. It's much quicker to get to Antarctica that way, and there are bigger ships there available. And so the vision was to take 1,000 women to Antarctica over 10 years. And actually, the applications for the sixth voyage have just opened, with about 100 women on each of them. So, you know, it's looking like it may get there. And, you know, at the core of Homeward Bound, we're trying to build a global network that can help to elevate the voices of women in science in global decision making around climate change, particularly, and also the impact and influence that they're able to have through their science. And kind of the central tenet is that we just can't afford, given the challenges that we face, to have so few senior women contributing to those decisions, and that we really are disadvantaged by a lack of diversity in senior levels of science and politics and more generally. So that's kind of what it's about.
Awesome. So, you know, you might have a future applicant here, but you might have many people listening. So what kind of things should people bear in mind if they're going to apply? So you fundraise for your spot, don't you?
That's right. Yeah.
Raise the money for a berth.
Yes.
So that you can go. And how long is the trip usually? Isn't it 3 weeks?
Yeah, about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't been on one yet.
Really?
Well, you know, small kids and
I assumed that, you know, you went on all of them.
No.
Oh, wow.
No. And, you know, for various reasons. My main involvement was at the birth of Homeward Bound, and have stepped back to some degree and just watched it grow into something even more amazing than we thought might have been possible at the start. But
yeah,
it's very exciting.
So what have some of the essentially outputs or impacts been of Homeward Bound so far? So the five voyages have already occurred.
Yeah, I think the fifth one is still to go, and then the sixth has just opened. Yeah, so, well, I think, you know, from my perspective, that network that has developed has just been so powerful, and I have seen stories of you know, women make huge changes in their careers and their lives to kind of prompted by that experience to pursue the things that they see as important to them. And, you know, I think one of the strengths is that the participants are from such broad areas of science. So the criterion is having a background in science. You don't have to be someone that actually works as a scientist.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, people working in medicine, in industry, in engineering, in education, and across a really broad range of ages and career stages. So that's been fantastic in terms of that support network that's developed and the actions particularly around addressing climate change that have emerged from that.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. It sounds like such a great opportunity. So yeah. Hopefully, you know, head to we'll just Google Homeward Bound and you'll find information on the application. I have been to the website before and it looks really, really cool. The way it's set up kind of looks like moody and like really badass, which
I
love.
I designed that initial website because we didn't have anyone else to do it and I'd never designed a website before.
Yeah, no, I've been on it. Can say it's very, very good. So we always like to finish our shows on a bit of like constructive journalism or like a hopeful, constructive approach. So I think Homeward Bound really encapsulates that, where it's women supporting women, it's elevating voices across the spectrum. It's not just early career researchers or people just in science, which is important because it shows that we need diversity in decision making as a whole.
Yep.
So what kind of things are you excited or hopeful about for the future? That's a big question.
Yeah, that is. So a couple of things spring to mind. One is that I think, and we've kind of touched on this already, that, you know, it's a question of diversity more generally, right? There are specific issues for women and particularly women from minority ethnic backgrounds, for instance, working in these fields that can be, you know, all kinds of challenges, but when we talk about diversity, I think that can be much broader than just gender equality, and I think that's that conversation is emerging and is a more complex one, and how do we, it would be really, I'd love to see all of those threads come together in a way that, you know, we're no longer kind of
siloed.
Yeah, that's right. Or, you know, trying to tick boxes to meet quotas or check balances in terms of how we represent diversity in whatever process. So I'm excited to see that happen. And I think the other message, you know, is more in relation to the challenge of climate change, and is one that I did delivered an occasional address to a science graduation at UTAS back in December, which is actually one of the scariest things. I had all of these academics sitting behind me and many of them were like lecturers I'd had as an undergraduate. Anyhow, the message I tried to deliver there is that, you know, a future with climate change is a frightening one, and particularly if you are a younger person and understand how different the world might look and what risks and threats lie ahead. But I think the flip side is that it's also a time of incredible opportunity to make a difference. And so, you know, arguably there's been no other time in human history when we can make such significant differences to, you know, the future for the coming generations. And so, I think having kids myself who I would love to see become scientists or whatever pathway they take, there are, you know, important and exciting opportunities there to turn things around and create a better, more sustainable future for everybody. So wouldn't that be lovely if that could happen?
I can't think of a better note really to finish on. I couldn't agree with both points more. Whenever I hear all the doom and gloom and the anxiety, yeah, I'm like, out of really dire circumstances is usually a rife breeding ground for innovation and opportunity if you just seize it and look at it a different way.
Yeah.
And yes, we need to be holding policymakers to account and everything, but we can also be driving that change from the consumer level up. And I think we're seeing that. So thank you to Dr. Jess Melvin-Thomas so much for
Pleasure.
Being my guest.
Thank you.
This has been really, really enjoyable. And you've been listening to That's What I Call Science. We love bringing you science-related content and hope you enjoyed the show. Do like or subscribe to us on your podcast service. And apparently, if you give us a review, that like boosts our visibility. So that would be awesome too. And as always, please get in touch on social media. Just search That's What I Call Science or That's Science Taz on any of your social media platforms. My name's Neve Chapman. Head to edgeradio.org.au for more information on all the good stuff they're doing.